Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, health, food, policy, science, and the media, and bringing you every week on Connect the Dots the many facets of things that are impacting us in our interconnected world, ranging from the health of our food, water, air, and earth to the health of our communities, the health of our environment, and, of course, the thing that is affecting all of that forever, and especially so nowadays, the health or lack thereof of our society. Each week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different journalists, advocates, thought leaders, filmmakers, authors, scientists, and more to uncover different things in this broad spectrum and orient you to the challenges of today's reality and the activism and engagement we need to do to protect the well-being of ourselves, our country, and the earth itself. On today's show, I'm delighted to have with me Joshua Frank, the managing editor of Counterpunch, one of my most favorite publications. And for those of you who have, for the 8 years that we've been on the air, heard me railing about the inadequacy and corruption of the mainstream media, and, you know, I always am asked, well, what websites do you like? Where should we read? Where should we go? And one that I read regularly, post from regularly on my Facebook page, and, you know, enjoin everyone to follow is Counterpunch. Joshua Frank is managing editor of Counterpunch. He also has written a book recently called Hopeless: Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. Love that title. Co-edited with Jeffrey St. Clair and published by AK Press. So on the show today, we're going to be talking about, you know, some current issues, some background, and, you know, some things we need to get a handle on and get clarity about in the challenge of the Trump administration as it sort of powers forward through our laws, our regulation, our government, and, you know, and unfortunately, the earth itself in a very, very detrimental way. So I'm delighted to have you with us today. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Joshua Frank.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for reading and promoting Counterpunch.
Well, you know, big fan. Really terrific articles. I mean, on right now on the site, for example, there's a piece by Dean Baker, who's one of, you know, the leading economic experts on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other trade agreements, which we've covered extensively, exhaustively. He's actually a prior guest on the show too, as well as a whole host of other topics. You know, one of the things in today's world is that you know, the media, there's such a range of opinion. The opinion is often divisive. It's really important to know where to get your news from. That's a constant theme on this show. And Counterpunch is really doing heavy lifting in that department. So, you know, always grateful. So, you know, what is, in your view, the most kind of critical negatives of what Donald Trump, 45, some prefer to call him, not wanting to use his name or a more insulting version of it, for that matter. You know, what is he serving up that we need, especially now at this time as we're talking, because, of course, it's a rolling unveiling of a series of horrible deconstructive initiatives that's always seems to be changing. You know, what do we have to be most concerned about now, in your view?
Sure. Well, you know, I think a way to start with this is to really kind of address the ways that we have already beat him back, right? And whether it's some of his immigration policy. You know, today we have news that Steve Bannon is now kicked off the National Security Council. There are things happening, and the Trump administration is definitely in turmoil. With that said, I cut my teeth as an environmental journalist and as an environmentalist as well, and I am definitely deeply concerned with not only the rhetoric coming out of the administration, but the policies of, for instance, gutting the EPA, gutting the National Park Service, essentially pulling back the regulatory framework that holds corporations, polluters accountable. That, to me, at this juncture, is the most frightening prospect, because when you take away that framework that was put in place, you know, during probably our most progressive president in Richard Nixon, in the environmental sense, you know, it's setting up the stage for a very, you know, a horrible, detrimental future for not only humans, but for the entire planet. So that, mm-hmm. that to me, is the most dire situation, and I think needs most attention at this moment. And unfortunately, the opposition party is not is nowhere to be seen when it comes down to it. And of course, in many ways, they set this up to begin with. So that, to me, seems to be the biggest concern. And of course, at the heart of it is climate change and its impacts on the world.
Mm-hmm. You know, it remains for some people, you know, the number one concern, and for others, it's almost like, you know, if it isn't happening to me today and right now, I can't get my mind around it. You know, that's mm-hmm. another group, or you know, it's going to happen 200 years from now. And gee, you know, my great grandchildren, whom I can hardly picture, you know, they may have to deal with something, but, you know, technology can maybe save the day. You know, these are the, and then, of course, there are the people who are outright deniers. I'm actually taking now to calling them liars, because, mm-hmm. you know, climate liars, because, you know, I mean, I think we've, tolerated the term denial, which kind of implies that, you know, there are two sides to this, or, you know, I deny the science and I'm questioning the science as if I'm qualified to question the science, and many, you know, most of the people who are questioning it are not qualified to question it at all. You know, and in fact, you know, they're aware, and the people who have been advancing that initiative are certainly aware of the reality. It's just that it counters their business interests. They don't care. And, you know, they've come up with a lot of the cat ate my lunch. I mean, this is lying, you know. So I think really we have to start kind of calling it lying, because that's really what it is. And if mm-hmm. it's lying because of stupidity or, you know, or whatever, it's still lying, you know. And the way they target us, I think we, you know, we have to get a little more aggressive about it. But, you know, what do you see from your read of the science as the time frame, for example, of the likely trajectory of impacts that we could be on?
Well, I mean, it varies, but I mean, we're already seeing the impacts, and in some ways, and there's bits of the science that indicate we're at a point of no return, although it could be a snowball effect, right? I mean, if we go up another 2 degrees in the next 10 years, we're going to have a catastrophic impact, of course, but if we go up 4 degrees in 50 years, it could be even more catastrophic. So there's, you know, there's varying degrees. I think that the key now is to fight what we can fight and not worry about the doom and gloom of it, and worry mm-hmm. more about the impacts that we have right now. I mean, for instance, we can talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline. We could talk about, you know, a number of things that are happening that we can still fight, you know, and there are some hopeful signs. And I think it's very easy to get sucked into the darkness of it, right? And, mm-hmm. and I think as an activist, as people that are concerned, it's very important to hold on to the nuggets of good. For instance, mm-hmm. right now we've had I believe 8. Financiers, banks pull out funding from the tar sands because tar sands right now is not seen profitable. That directly impacts the future of the Dakota Access Pipeline. If the oil is too expensive to harvest, the pipeline will not be profitable, and that is actually obviously a good thing, right? Just as we've seen fracking of oil collapse in the Bakken in North Dakota, because prices are so high, oil prices are so low, the cost of extracting it is so high that a lot of people, it's basically had a total collapse there. It's not to say that it can't come back in some ways, but there are other things at play going on, especially with the oil production, but we have to hold on to those things as good things. Another really positive thing is that we're seeing a completely decline globally in coal production. I think something like 80% of proposed coal plants in China, for instance, over the next decade have been canceled. That's a huge victory. It's a huge victory for the climate. It's a huge victory for us. And those are the things I think we need to hold on to and continue to work toward. And I think that we're winning those battles in many ways, even if Trump is a setback in others.
You know, that's really interesting because, you know, on the one hand, people that I'm sure you know, who are out there are grieving the fact that the oil is actually proceeding into the pipe, you know, at this point. But on the other hand, the very same week, you know, someone who I have counted as a friend and you know, fellow advocate and colleague was in Norway with five or six indigenous women who were speaking before the Norwegian legislature, who were on primetime television, and you know, they started basically pulling the plug. What happens if they've built under the river, the oil is flowing, but it becomes unprofitable? They just kind of plug it up and it's over?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm not an oil executive, so I don't have to make those decisions. But I think, you know, if the oil were to stop, it would be better than for it to continue to flow. And any time that the oil industry takes a hit is a good day. And at any time that renewable gets a boost, it's a good day. So I think, and, you know, and I think we have a lot of good days in our future, despite what might seem as a dire situation. And in many ways, it may be, but it could be worse.
So what are did you have the opportunity to go out to Standing Rock yourself, or were you guys covering it either, you know, through people there or, you know, in connection with people who were there?
I was not at Standing Rock, but we did have quite a few people on the ground. Margot Kidder, who the actress and activist, wrote a number of pieces for us, and she was there for, I think, you know, well, she was there during the end, and she was there for several weeks. We had a couple other activists on the ground as well, writing about what was going on. And it was definitely, I think, Jeff Reese St. Clair, my co-editor, and I would agree, probably the biggest environmental action that we've seen in the last 10 years. And my hope is that this can transform the environmental movement and reinvigorate the Native Americans that are impacted by the extraction industry, and come together around, you know, put their differences aside and come together around a central issue, which is protecting the environment. And I hope that environmentalists will follow their lead. And so we'll see where it goes, but that's my hope. And I think that we can learn a lot from Standing Rock and the people that put it together and the organizers and the effort that went behind it.
What do you see? I mean, obviously, the fact that this is a people with an ancestry and a history, but what were the takeaways from, you know, I mean, it makes it really different from, you know, other environmental causes that we've, you know, that we've seen. What do you consider the lessons learned in terms of, you know, what could be adopted by the rest of the movement?
Well, I think key to it is that it was a grassroots movement. It was not a movement that was top-down. It wasn't a movement that was a clickbait movement that was put on by the big green organizations, although certainly they supported it. They weren't the ones profiting from it by, you know, dollars being donated by their membership. They weren't the ones dictating the direction of the movement. The movement itself was very organic. I thought it was leaderless in many ways, as far as the passion. I think that those are the takeaways of a positive transformation of the environmental movement. I mean, I think if we, it's probably a whole other discussion, but the environmental movement has essentially been eviscerated in its potency because of the top-down structure of the environmental movement more generally, whether it's the big green organizations that are dictating it or the foundations that control those environmental groups. And I think with Standing Rock, it was free of those shackles and was able to adapt as needed in a way that we hadn't seen before. And I was very excited not to see you know, white males out there leading the charge. We saw indigenous movement leading the charge, and that's a very positive, you know, a positive thing to witness, especially if we haven't seen it in a very long time.
I completely agree with you. It's really true. You know, I covering the Trans-Pacific Partnership threat, which, you know, has temporarily do-si-do'd away, but will come back. You know, these trade agreements, either through revisions of NAFTA or in other ways, will come back in other forms, you know, in such a corporate-driven administration as this one, ready to, you know, wanting to do deals everywhere, regardless of the impacts. But, you know, during that whole time, it was really, with the exception of Friends of the Earth, it was really hard work to get any of the major environmental groups to do anything other than the mildest lip service against agreements that would basically globalize every problem that we have seen and identified in this country, whether it's dirty drilling, greenhouse gas release, pipelines, you know, all of the problems that we are experiencing in different communities in this country are going to be disseminated around the world. That's really one of the major goals of these global agreements, if and as they, you know, are pushed to proceed, and, you know, with the climate impacts that are so dangerous. And yet, you know, the organizations were kind of like, you know, we're into divestment, and, you know, and it's not the divestment of colleges, pension funds is a bad thing, but it wasn't, you know, I mean, it has some impact. I don't want to denigrate it, but, you know, when you have plans to, you know, this kind of, you know, every war and every place where we're trying to, you know, ostensibly help but really control, it's because of, you know, gas and oil or uranium development. It's really almost always about energy development anywhere in the world. And, you know, so we can't just kind of put up puppets, you know, and go out on boats and, you know, and make a little drama. You know, it's we kind of have to be more comprehensive in the ways
well,
this pops
and,
up.
And,
so I completely agree with you.
Yeah, and at the heart of that, what you're saying, right, is the economics of it. And one of the problems with big green organizations where, and let's be clear, they control the money and they control the resources, they control most of the actions. These are not democratic institutions. They might pretend to be. But when you're not a democratic institution, you tend to have a monolithic sort of view on what works and what doesn't work, and usually those methods don't work in the end. They lose. And so I think what was really a positive takeaway, for instance, Standing Rock, was that it was not monolithic. It was democratic. And I think that's the takeaway when addressing and adapting to all the challenges that we're going to face in the future. And I think at the heart of the climate change fiasco, certainly energy extraction in the energy industry more generally, and of course with that trade, is central to that. So hopefully we can continue to, you know, expand our activism and look outside of the mainstream environmental groups to get shit done.
I really appreciate that. You know, one of the things, too, with the climate march upcoming, you know, there are people enthusiastically organizing, you know, and I mean, and I also hear people going, oh, again, and what is going to be the takeaway out of this time, you know, because the last time there was a march, everyone, I was at the march, everyone felt great participating, And then nothing happened afterward. There was, it just was like a dramatic expression that, you know, that had no aftermath. It didn't become the basis for further organizing. So I agree with you. I think having, and one of the great things, too, is that rather than having one or two noble leaders, you know, who are there to protect us, is to see the diversity of the people who care passionately about the earth, about their community, about their community's water, about their neighborhood, about, you know, and you know, that's what, I mean, if there's a, environmentalism is grassroots. It's not only about the rights of the future, although that's important, you know, that people should have clean air and water and all the rest of it, but it's also about the places mm-hmm. we love. And that we want to defend, and that to which we're connected, you know. And so to see all the people.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, certainly.
And it's not just connected to wild open places. Obviously, that's mm-hmm. one aspect of driving my own environmental ethic. But it can be community gardens. It can be food. It can be anything that. Is near and dear to people, and I think it's regionally based as well. And therefore, mm-hmm. I think the environmental movement would be good to diversify in that sense as well. Not only is funding, but other things. But you know, this is that's a whole a bag of worms. But I totally agree, and I think one of the positive things, you know, I look at this. For instance, you talked about the Women's March, the first big march. Mm-hmm. against Trump. Was that mm-hmm. It was a feel good march. I think that in many ways it was definitely positive. I think it was so soon after the inauguration, it just felt good for people to be around other people that weren't absolutely crazy. But you're absolutely right with that. That march and the upcoming march, climate march, it needs to transform into a political force. And unfortunately, the Democrats aren't that alternative political force. And my mm-hmm. hope is that one of the silver linings, perhaps, of the Trump administration is that people are awakened. People that perhaps weren't awakened during the Obama administration and Obama years, even though in many ways Obama was doing very, very awful things, whether it was fracking, whether it was, you know, bombing countries, continuing the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, you can go down the list. People weren't out in the streets marching. People weren't angry. People weren't as frustrated. There was, you know, a few of us on the left that were, but one of the silver linings, I think, of the Trump administration is that more people are awake, and if we can take that energy and push it, I think that we can actually continue to put pressure on this administration and the Congress that's enabling him on both sides of the aisle.
What is, you know, let's talk about that for a minute, because, I mean, I'll just share with you something that, you know, recently came up. I was at the DNC, and I was, you know, and of course all the speeches are heavily scripted. They're, you know, designed to appeal to the target audience, to make people feel good. And, you know, one of our senators from New York State, Kristen Gillibrand, you know, got up and was basically saying, you know, I'm for the children and the mothers, you know, I'm there to protect the kids, I'm a mommy kind of lady and all this kind of thing. And, right. you know, this induced a lot of gnashing of teeth among the grassroots fractivists in New York State and those who oppose the pipelines because, you know, basically, you know, for the years of both the Indian Point AIM pipeline as well as the compressor station and Minisink, all the battles that we've had in the state to keep contaminating, you know, climate change driving gas infrastructures out of the state, you know, and some of them actually life endangering, like, you know, the AIM pipeline through the nuclear power plant Indian Point. You know, our senators mm-hmm. just, you know, smiled and given lip service, and actually, Gillibrand herself turned and walked away from a demonstration against one of these with little children present. And so the women organizers in New York are, you know, very leery of her. And so, you know, someone can get on national television and say what an appealing person she is, saying I love children and everything. But, you know, playing what I call the mommy card. But, you know, but we've had a very an experience of her coldness, unresponsiveness, in really protecting our children, you know. So, and I'm not the only one who feels this way. This is a widespread feeling among people organizing. And so right now, for example, you know, she spoke, you know, she kind of got off her mommy platform, to use the F word, speaking on the Hill, you know, recently, and said, you know, if you're not here to do the work of, you know, taking care of the people, just, you know, go effing away, you know, kind of thing. You know, and this was in response to the Gorsuch battle, you know, for the Supreme Court nomination. So there's an example, you know, like, how do we react to this? We have somebody who's a Democrat. Nationally, she could look good to people who don't know her. We know slightly different. She is one of the lone people that's kind of standing up on a particular issue, this, you know, horrible issue, this awful nomination. So it's kind of like you go, it gives you a little hope. You want to be grateful that anyone's standing up. And yet you know that on other issues, they'll, you know, the same group of people will be highly inconsistent. They'll turn around and diss the public outcry or turn a deaf ear. You know, how can people, how are we supposed to respond to that? How do we educate people not to go, you know, go out with hope every time when we so much need hope in this time, and, you know, and look to the Democratic Party as they're going to save us?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important questions that progressives and people who identify on the left have to grapple with. And I think the perfect example of that in the last election cycle was Bernie Sanders, how the left responded to Bernie Sanders, how Bernie Sanders let down, I believe, I would argue, his followers and his movement, and where he's at now as a result of that, and where we're at now as a result of that. I mean, look, if Bernie Sanders had decided he was not going to support Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton was not going to support his ideals and let's be clear, it wasn't necessarily about Bernie Sanders. I mean, I've talked to a lot of his supporters, and many of them, of course, they love Bernie, but they love more what he was talking about: Medicare for all, free college education. You know, a lot of very important issues that I actually agree with as well. But it's about the issues, not the people that are representing those issues. In that case, Bernie Sanders, right? I mean, if Bernie Sanders had decided, look, I'm not going to support a candidacy of Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton does not support the issues that are near and dear to my constituents, my followers, and the people that are excited about my campaign. And if she doesn't support those ideals, I'm not going to support her, and I'm going to be an independent, and that's just how it is. And he didn't do that, obviously. In fact, he did the opposite, which was, supporting Hillary Clinton at all costs is more important than the last 2 years of campaigning that I did on the issue that I claim to care about. So he not only let his people down, he let all of those important initiatives down as well. And now he's trying to, I would say, co-opt the movement again. And I don't know if people are aware or not of how detrimental that is to movement building, and of course the Democrats have long been the graveyard of social movements. But my advice would be stick to the issues, not the politicians that claim to represent those issues. Only then can we move forward and actually make positive change.
I think that's really an important point. You know, we have such a personality-driven culture. You know, we want to kind of hang our hat somewhere and say, this guy or this woman will take care of it. We're done. But, you know, it's not getting taken care of. So, yeah, no, I totally hear you. You know, part of it, of course, is just sheer panic at the prospect of Trump, what he's doing now, and what he will do, that leads us to try to, like, hang our hat on anyone who opposes anything, and suddenly they become our hero or heroine. You know, but also, you know, we hope that maybe, you know, many people have been hoping ever since almost the hour he was elected, he'll be impeached. He collaborated with Russia. Let's impeach him, you know, because, hey, now, you know, that's a good out for us. What can, you know, let's pursue that. And, you know, if we just pursue any hope about this, maybe we can get rid of this guy before he does further damage. But, I mean, is, for example, in your view, the Russian stratagem, you know, going to work, you know, working in our favor, or is it just a waste of energy and a kind of distraction and delusion in some way?
I mean, I think at this point, what we know, what evidence we have of Russian meddling in the election isn't enough to warrant all of our energy. I'm not saying that they did or they didn't try to manipulate the election, but I would argue that at this point it's not as important as fighting the issues and the things that Trump is doing now. I don't think it solves the greater quandary, which is we have an outlaw administration, whether or not Trump is at the helm. I mean, if as we were talking about before we started recording, if Trump is impeached, then we have to deal with Mike Pence. And Mike Pence, in many ways, may be much more dangerous because he's actually a lot smarter politically. And I would say much more ideologically driven, which can be pretty darn dangerous, right? So we have a bigger problem here. We have an administration and a Congress that is basically against most of the core values of progressives, of the left, of human rights, of the environment. That's the bigger issue. Russia isn't the issue. I think the one thing with Russia that we need to be careful about, though, is if this meddling, if Russia's alleged hacking or whatever you want to call it, is used as a pretext to go to war or anything of that matter. Of course, we need to oppose that. But at this point, I don't see it going that way just yet. And I think in many ways, the Russian hacking debacle, more than anything, is a big distraction. And I think Trump may even know that. And he's in some ways probably happy about it because he's able to get away with other stuff while everybody's worrying about these other allegations that are unsubstantiated.
Yeah, you know, is there substance there? Because every time I check, there hasn't been a lot of substance. But, you know, a couple of times a week, somebody will crop up and say, aha, now they've nabbed him. You know, oh, boy, this is going to be good, you know. And yet nothing, this is going on now. I mean, we're speaking, it's April.
Yeah.
You know, this is, what is it now? It's like 4 months, going on 5 months. What, do they have anything? I mean, do they have anything at all? What do they have?
Well, I think it's important to realize, you know, we only are privy to the portion of all of this that makes its way into the media, and we're able to digest it because none of us are insiders. None of us are inside of the intelligence community, and I think if we're going to talk about any of that, I mean, it's probably more important to talk about the divide, I would say, within the intelligence community. And I'm careful not to call anything deep state because, you know, there have been these theories that the deep state is against Trump, but I would argue that the deep state has varying interests when you get down to it. The oil industry might have different objectives than the CIA, for instance. Or it's not monolithic, not a single organism. But with that said, the intelligence community definitely is split on Trump, and many of them, I would say, don't like Trump. It's pretty obvious. And I would say there's a wing of the Republican Party that doesn't like Trump, and that I would call that the John McCain wing of the party. kind of the old guard that is pro-intelligence. And there's a lot going on there. There's a lot at play. I think that McCain and his acolytes are using Russia, as the Democrats are, actually, to tarnish Trump, to go after Trump. But it's more of an excuse than the reason. And I think if it wasn't Russia, they would be looking for other ways to delegitimize him and his power. And so I think that's a bigger story, not necessarily Russia and Putin and what their impact was on the election, per se.
So these are basically, in other words, there are, you know, multiple parties in different directions that are disliking this, you know, administration for other reasons. What is the rationale? Why does John McCain actually dislike Trump? Because he won and he didn't, or you
well,
know, like, why does he like
it? I mean, I'm happy to say I don't know John McCain. So I would say that it's more personal than anything. I think that of course, going back to, you know, aside from what my personal beliefs are on John McCain, John McCain was, I wouldn't call him a war hero. He certainly wasn't, he was definitely abused and a victim. And, Trump went after him personally. There's a lot of those cases out there with a lot of Republicans that Trump went after personally. People don't like Trump. Mm-hmm. He's unhinged. They don't think that he represents conservative values. They think that he's leading the party in the wrong direction. I think a lot of them are concerned that in 2 years from now or a year and a half from now, when they go through the midterm election, that they're going to get ruined because of Trump's popularity is continuing to plummet. As long as they can form a wing of the Republicans that don't support Trump, they might be able to fend off some of those losses in the House. I think there's a strategy there. I think there's part of the Republicans would like to see Paul Ryan leave. I think that was also part of why they sabotaged their own health care bill. They don't see Paul Ryan as an actual advocate of conservative values. I think they see him as aligning with Trump too much, more than he should. Obviously, Paul Ryan has changed his tune. He wasn't necessarily against Trump all out during the election, but he wasn't in support of Trump either. I think there's an internal fight going on with the Republicans, and Russia, again, is one of the, you know, the easy scapegoats there, but there's a lot more at play. And I think a lot of the Democrats are happy to feed into that and just watch the Republicans lose their mind.
What do you think are our best strategies on the left for, you know, mounting the kind of resistance that is going to be truly effective? If all of these distracting things are coming along, where do you see the kind of light shining, on the landscape in terms of what we should be looking for? I mean, one of the things, for example, that struck me about the Women's March, great expression of solidarity, that's movement building to have an expression, but you also then need a plan. And the website afterward was kind of send your senator a postcard,
Right.
And, given the state of donors, buying elected officials on both sides of the aisle, it's not wrong and horrible to send somebody a postcard, but, they didn't have any plan, send them a postcard, and there were a lot of people galvanized who were not otherwise or priorly civically engaged, and they were just like okay, I'm going to send my senator a postcard, kind of thing. So, I didn't feel that was that constructive. And people are kind of casting about what will be constructive. So I'd love to hear your take on that.
Well, I think, first off, what's important for anybody that is becoming invigorated, that, and I think this goes out to a lot of people that were brought into the political process through Bernie Sanders, and a lot of those people are millennials. This was their is their first. They were raised with Obama. They probably don't remember much of Bush. This is their first presidential election. Probably the first time they were getting excited about politics. And now they're like, "What's going on?" Right? They're like, "What happened?"
Right.
Everything I hoped and fought for, it's completely the opposite. Right. And I think in that sense, you can get pretty darn demoralized. But I would say that that's where those marches are important. But with that, it's remember that this is about movement building, and it's more about that than it is about any particular candidate. And I think every person that maybe was invigorated by Bernie Sanders or what have you, or Jill Stein with the Green Party or whatever, has their issues that are most near and dear to them. And the important thing is to continue to fight for those issues no matter who is in office. And so my hope is that with this, not only will it invigorate independent politics, the Green Party and other small independent groups at the city council level, at the state level, but it will also continue to mobilize people around issues that affect their daily lives. And I believe that's the hope that I have, that this could transform. And, of course, our youth, and you can look at every positive social movement, the youth are typically the nucleus and that driving force and the motivation and the artistic direction of those movements. And I hope that Trump can, the opposition to Trump can continue to foster that mobilization. And that's my hope that I have. My advice would be to stick to your guns and stick to your passion and stick to the issues that matter most to you, no matter if it's Trump or if it's Pence or if it was Hillary Clinton. And I think that's hopefully that political awakening that's happening now for so many can be transformed into something tangible in the future.
Yeah, that's right. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, one of the things that I think was, you know, a big factor in the actual election was the generational divide.
Right.
You know, boomer generation, you know, some were Sanders loyalists and some were like, okay, she won fair and square, you know, we're going with Clinton kind of thing. And actually, you know, I know many people like this couldn't see a problem with it, you know, and they were kind of like, what's wrong with these millennials? Why don't these whippersnappers kind of shape up and go along with the program? You know, now that we have a candidate, I don't understand the problem, you know, kind of thing. So there was a sort of divide. Now that I don't want to say thankfully that's over now because we have Trump, but I mean, in a sense, it is over, at least temporarily, until we have to reconstitute because we do have Trump. And everyone can once again agree they don't like what he's doing. No one likes what he's doing anywhere on the left, right? But when it really, you know, when it comes down to the next election and the future, you know, where are we going to be on bridging those divides? Do you think that it's really going to be the millennial generation coming to the fore, taking the lead, and, you know, kind of bringing about the transformation, having been awakened, you know, with some support from whoever supports? Or do you think we're going to be back in the, you know, that kind of lockerhead position with blame passing back and forth as happened, you know, in the recent election on, you know, in the liberal side of the spectrum or the so-called liberal side of the spectrum? You know, how do we get past that? What's the opportunity and what do you see as the way that can happen or is happening?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, unfortunately, I don't think, for instance, the Democrats are responding. We saw during the election with Hillary Clinton, she didn't adopt any of the progressive platform of Bernie Sanders and of his constituents and of millennials more generally. She just didn't do it. And in fact, a probably good argument to be made that Trump used a lot of the rhetoric better than she did, especially when it came to, you know, came to trade. I think, and then of course, after the Democrats continue, you know, totally were obliterated in November, who do they rise to the top of the heap to lead the party? Chuck Schumer, right? They're not listening to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. They never have listened to the wing of the progressive Democratic Party, or if there is that even left progressive wing. So I don't put a lot of hope in the Democrats. With that said, mm-hmm. I am hopeful that those people that are aware of what Trump is doing, and they're aware that in a lot of ways it's a continuation of a lot of the horrid policies that have been put in place back mm-hmm. to the Bill Clinton administration, whether it's mm-hmm. Neoliberalism, whether it's our wars in the Middle East, and mm-hmm. so on. I think that if people realize, instead of putting their hopes and aspirations into a single party of opposition, they put it into action. And I would say that if for some reason, the Democrats decide we're going to nominate Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders again, or he runs, that at the very least, those people that are aware and are awakened will hold them accountable as well. Because no mm-hmm. candidate and no party is perfect, but instead of becoming a cheerleader, let's become the driving force to make those candidates better and to hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. And the only way the Democrats are ever going to respond to progressives and to the left is if they mm-hmm. are fearful of losing votes. Until they mm-hmm. are fearful of losing votes, they won't listen to us. And that's why Hillary Clinton didn't listen to us, because she thought that she had us in her back pocket. And in doing so, I would argue it cost her the election more than any Russian hacking scheme.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really interesting and provocative statement. But it also takes us back into the divide. Because, there were, I heard gnashing of teeth and screaming. Many people saying, Dem exit, I'm out of here, I'll never vote for her, never Hillary, all of that, right? And then, and then later they blamed, it's because of you that we have this Trump situation. There was ample warning, and then ample. And yet, then there's another group that's like, what's the problem with them? We're just going along. This is how, we've seen elections won our whole lives, for decades and decades, and what should be different, and we don't like him, and this is our only option. And, and they're right in that tug of war. So there was plenty of signs. And, in fact, I was in that breach in my own reporting saying, come to us, Hillary, give us something here, we don't have, and Jimmy Dore, actually, he made the point, and it completely resonated with me, and I kind of used it constantly in every one of the articles I did and arguments I made. It's like, the politician doesn't say, you come to me, I'm with her. They go to you. That's how you win votes. And she was absolutely, unbudgeable. That takes us back to your book that you have recently done, because it's like the Democratic Party style of kind of giving hints that I'm doing something that will, please you or appeal to you, or that's enough, that some people are lulled by and other people call BS on. That style harkens back to Obama and to Bill Clinton. I'd love to hear how you saw that in terms of your recent book.
Yeah, I think it's important to, when we talk about Obama and the rise of Obama, to remember mm-hmm. that we were coming out of the dark ages of the Bush administration.
It's important to
realize that, as critical as I am of Barack Obama, even then, I think putting in a social context of our first black president and how radical that is in a transformation of the U.S. view of history. And that was a real driving force. And of course, mm-hmm. he also seemed like an outsider, right? He ran mm-hmm. as an outsider. He took on the Clintons and he beat them. And he was a very gifted orator, and he mm-hmm. had a track record that was pretty mainstream, but I would say a little left of center in most ways. But of course, mm-hmm. when he went to office, he completely disappointed right off the bat, right? He totally bailed out Wall Street, almost probably the first action that he did. He rolled back and continued the assault on civil liberties. I mean, we could go down the list of all the bad things that he did and accomplished, and without much opposition. And of course, during the we had some movements that sprouted up during the Obama administration, and I think talking about those is kind of important because one of those was Occupy Wall Street, and mm-hmm. Occupy Wall Street really came to the fore during and up to Obama's reelection. Well, mm-hmm. what did the Democrats and what were they able to do? They were able to co-opt that movement because, you know, they believed, naively perhaps, that Occupy or electing a Democrat was going to be more important to their movement than continuing their movement. And the Democrats did their best mm-hmm. to co-opt that movement, and they think they were successful at it. And in doing so, that movement has pretty much been eviscerated. There's little fragments of it left, but it's nothing tangible anymore. It's not making mm-hmm. headlines like it did at the time. And I think that's mm-hmm. to me the real takeaway from the Obama years is that there was no progressive anti-war environmental. We saw aspects of the environmental movement, but a lot of them just were catering to the Democrats and controlled by the big green organizations. We didn't see really any grassroots movement sprouting up, except perhaps for during the very tail end of Obama during the Standing Rock protest. But other mm-hmm. than that, there was nothing, especially in comparison to what was happening 8 years prior during Bush years, right? We had mm-hmm. we had a lot of actions going on a number of fronts in the early 2000s and mm-hmm. reaction, and even before that, you know, with the globalization movement in Seattle in 99, and then, of course, after the 9/11 attacks, opposing the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, as assault on civil liberties, all of these things that people were out fighting, even though many of them were being continued under Obama, we didn't see that opposition. And so for me, I think the takeaway is, look, we could have made Obama better in many ways, but he didn't feel the pressure from the left. He didn't feel that mm-hmm. pressure. He might have responded mm-hmm. to it had he felt it, but he didn't feel it. And so if we are to see a Democrat win in 4 years, or someone that might even be left of center, like an Elizabeth Warren type, we have to keep the pressure on her because she is more apt to listen to us than I would say most Republicans are, right? And the Republicans, and if there's anything we can learn from the Republicans, it's that they are willing to put pressure on their own party. I mean, the radical right puts pressure on the center all the time, and they're very successful at it, and they win because of it. But we could learn that. I mean, learn from that. On the left, we don't have that. We always cave, and we're always too worried about lesser evil this, lesser evil that, and instead of sticking mm-hmm. to the issues that are most important to us. So if I had one takeaway from the Obama years, it would be that we didn't put enough pressure on him, and as a result, it hurt a number of progressive causes.
You know, it's really interesting because talking to you and hearing your perspectives on these things, I'm really getting the picture that even though we have this horror of this president and everything and his horrible corporate initiatives, in a way, we're in the better shape for really getting our act together than we ever have been. I mean, one of the big limiting factors with Obama was, you know, the breakthrough black president, the, you know, loving family man, the personally likable individual, you know, the, you know, well-spoken and all. It was almost like sacrilegious to say boo to him, you know. And, you know, and it so and I think with Clinton, there was obviously far less reverence, to put it mildly. So in a way, all we're right. in good shape here, you know, in terms
well,
of like really organizing.
Yeah.
And we're actually coming down to the end of the show here, so I just want to say that we have about another 2 minutes. So,
okay, well, I won't
your final thought then, and then we'll.
Yeah, I won't ramble on too long, but I would just say that I totally agree, and I think, you know, I come across people, friends, family, fellow activists and writers that are just completely depressed, right? They're mm-hmm. down in the dump. They cannot believe that they're living in this era of Trump. And all I can say mm-hmm. to them is, if we continue to be down in the dumps and we continue to be depressed, he wins. Then he's mm-hmm. winning. Let's not let him mm-hmm. win. Let's be invigorated by the fact that so many people are on our side. The majority of Americans didn't vote for Trump, right? We mm-hmm. have a very unpopular president in the White House right now, and that means most people around us agree with us, right? And that's a positive thing. And if we can turn that into activism and people that now are maybe when they were on the fence about getting out there during Obama, now they're ready to be active, let's get them excited. Let's get them involved in the political process. Let's get them involved on local issues in their neighborhoods or in their states or their cities. And let's make some positive change because we have the opportunity to do that now. And I think that's the silver lining of this egregious Trump administration is that people now are walking around eyes wide open, and that's a very important distinction.
Yeah, no, that's really terrific. I love your whole perspective on this. Thank you. It's so wonderful. We're going to have to close out the show, people. We've been talking with Joshua Frank, managing editor of Counterpunch. Read Counterpunch. They're online at counterpunch.org. His most recent book is Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion, which I'm sure also applies to kind of seeing through some of the persisting problems that we have with the Democratic Party in the current administration. Thank you so much for being with us today on the show. I really love your perspective. And, you know, we have a lot. We can roll up our sleeves and do it. This is really our opportunity moment. Thank you, Joshua Frank.
And, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really been fun. And thank you, listeners, for being with us again for another edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I want to say the show closed, which I say every week, you know, and it really applies especially after this very uplifting talk with Joshua Frank. And that goes, chin up and keep marching forward.
Well, well, well. Well.